Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Bonulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. Charles is author, leading global finance blogger, and America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic, and Will You Be Richer or Poorer? And also, most recently, the book that we're focused on recently is Global Crisis, National Renewal, A Grand Strategy for the United States. His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. I'm looking forward to our discussion today on supply side and demand side inflation.
Yeah, it's great. It's a very interesting topic, also very timely given what's happening this week. We're talking here on Thursday, August 25th, but tomorrow's the big statement coming out from the sort of symposium being held, the annual symposium at in Wyoming, in terms of the event there. So with the Federal Reserve meeting, so Jackson Hole, Wyoming. So the topic we wanted to explore today is what the Fed is doing in relation to other central banks, and also in relation to fiscal stimulus spending. So you've got an article you wrote yesterday that's entitled "What's Worse Than Inflation? Depression Plus Inflation." So it's quite interesting, and you make a number of observations there that we'll explore in more detail. And I also want to highlight an article that was written also in the last day here by our research strategist, Ira Harris. He writes a blog called Notes from Underground. We also do a lot of podcasts together. And it's entitled Dear Jerome. And so he's sort of writing like a letter to him, in terms of discussing Federal Reserve policy. And he makes a number of interesting points in there, and he also makes reference to two other articles that are actually very similar to your article and to Ira's points in his article. One is from The Telegraph's Ambrose Evans Pritchard. He wrote an article also this week that was entitled "The U.S. Federal Reserve Actively Wishes to Crush Stock Markets. Ignore It at Your Own Peril." And so in that article, Evans Pritchard delineates what the Fed's objective is, and Jerome Powell and his minions, as Ira refers to him, are now on a mission to redeem themselves, Evans Pritchard writes, and prove that they can conquer inflation after all. So in your article, you make a very interesting observation that there seems to be a willing cause for a depression, by increasing interest rates, quantitative tightening, sort of the hawkish stance of central banks, their intention appears to be to reduce supply constraint inflation. And you say very accurately that they will be proven tragically wrong. And so that's in your article. And then that last article, the fourth one, I just wanted to mention, is coming from economist Ed Yardini, who also has written as well very recently about the same subject, the same concepts, what's happening with the U.S. dollar and effects on the global financial system in a very negative way. But just if you could to discuss and elaborate on your article, that would be great, some of the points you make there.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. Yeah, it's a hot topic. I'll add two other articles, one from freightways.com, which was discussing how their demand is no longer the main driver of inflation. Supply chain issues are now pushing costs higher. So, you know, I think the model here, and I think the San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank had some research out recently on the same thing, that I think they were calling it sort of half-half, you know, half supply, half demand. But a lot of the demand was, as we know, temporary, right? So-called panic ordering and panic refilling of inventories. And so we can anticipate that ending. But I think the more interesting topic is how different this is from the stagflation inflation of the 1970s. And so it's interesting if we look at like sort of systemic approaches to inflation, we see a couple of common models. One is, of course, the hyperinflation of printing excess money, you know, like just the Weimar Republic model that impoverished Germany. Where the government just prints endless amounts of money that are completely out of proportion with the growth of the actual, you know, economy of goods and services. So there's that model that people are rightly afraid of. But then the other model in the 70s was the so-called stagflation, where wages were rising and then the cost of materials such as oil, you know, were rising for geopolitical reasons. And so fiscal stimulus was seen as the primary bête noire. Like this was the disaster, was to stimulate the economy to keep it growing, because this would then kick up inflation more than it would kick up growth. But I think we're in a different world now, and as I say, I think there's a lot of evidence here that that the depletion and, you know, causes of shortages, such as the breakdown of supply chains and drought and extreme weather conditions, these conditions have nothing to do with the monetary system. You know, you can raise interest rates 3 points or drop them 3 points. You're not going to get rid of the drought. You're not going to fill the rivers. You're not going to, the oceans will still be depleted of fresh fish and so on. And so I think we're facing a situation where our policy understanding is no longer in touch with the actual world we live in. And so that's what I find interesting. And so how do we deal with a inflation that's largely driven by scarcities that have nothing to do with the monetary system? And so if you're going to tighten conditions and squeeze demand, you're going to end up with a depression, because you're going to, if you do destroy the stock markets, you're going to destroy the spending power of the top 10% who own, you know, 80% of all the assets. But you're also going to, you know, impoverish the already poor, right, who will lose their jobs, who will see the prices of staples continuing to go up. And so they'll be impoverished from both directions. They'll be losing work and wages, and yet they'll still be paying more for essentials, because those cost increases have nothing to do with the monetary supply. So, and a depression is much worse than inflation. I think people forget that. But, you know, if you go back and read some of the history of the Great Depression globally, the suffering was much, much higher than if you have inflation at 6, 7, 8%. You know, if wages continue to go up and more or less match that, that's bearable. You know, it's painful, but everybody can get by. But if you create a depression, that creates a cycle of downward, you know, feedback loops that it's very difficult to get out of. And so I'm interested in what you see as to the causes of why we see all this fiscal stimulus at the same time that the central banks are talking so hawkishly.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So you've got fiscal policy and you've got monetary policy. I think what's happening now is there's sort of a balance between the two. Traditionally, everybody's looking at monetary policy, and it's been, you know, quantitative easing, printing of money, very loose monetary policy conditions for many years. That's been the way it's been looked at, and there's been a Federal Reserve put, you know, if the markets, equity markets go down, the Fed is there to lower interest rates and print more money and keep things going. So, but I think it's all changing now, whereby the monetary policy, in particular the U.S. Federal Reserve Central Bank, is now more of a focus on a sort of deflationary monetary policy, if you will, characterized by rising interest rates, a strong dollar for a number of reasons, but also quantitative tightening. So looking at their balance sheet and rolling off bonds, loans, assets that they have, just letting them expire but not renewing. So it's sort of quantitative tightening that will be happening, it is happening, and will be picking up a bit faster pace. So that is happening at the backdrop of fiscal stimulus. So what I see is more of a balance where the inflationary fiscal policy is now balancing the deflationary monetary policy. So why is there fiscal stimulus, or why is there a need? So that's an interesting question. I think what's happening is there's a number of factors on that. So you've got, first, if they are deflationary in the monetary policy, they have to go the other way, right, on fiscal policy. So there has to be some type of inflationary, you know, fiscal stimulus packages, that type of thing. And they have reasons to do so, right? There's a lot of initiatives going on, green energy, the green agenda type of thing, from different initiatives that are happening. Some of them are market environmentalism, some of them are agenda-based environmentalism. But so you have that happening. But there's also a bit of geopolitical interest here, I would call it, where, you know, you've got a situation now where there's tension geopolitically on a number of fronts between the U.S. sort of world, U.S.-led world, or the indebted Western world, if you will, and what's happening like with Russia and China, and sort of a bifurcation of the world, of the finance world, right? So you've got Russia, India, China, the BRICS countries, sort of aligning all together on the other side, and the sanctions, you know, from the war happening in the Ukraine, and potentially, geopolitical situation with Taiwan. And so you've got these sanctions that are, involving the SWIFT system, and also ultimately, therefore, involving the U.S. dollar system. So that's happening in a backdrop of this geopolitical tension. So traditionally, with the U.S. and a lot of the Western world being dependent on exports from Asia and these countries that are aligning on the bipolar opposite side of the U.S.-led world, there's now some problems or potential problems with getting supplies, parts for like keeping the military complex going, but also the overall entire economy going. So now it's, we have to make it here, right? We have to make it in the U.S., in Canada, Western Europe. But you know, a lot of that has been outsourced. There's in many cases no manufacturing base. That's all needed to be rebuilt. So therefore, you got to have this fiscal stimulus, right? So I think there's going to be a big push on that coming in the coming years to rebuild the manufacturing base, to do reshoring, essentially, you know, the, this uh, There's a part deglobalization going on. So all of this will necessitate things to be made here. Mining as well, like the dependency on rare earth metals that are very strategic. So, you know, increasing mining activity in certain areas as it may be strategic to the economy. So yeah, there's a lot of aspects for the fiscal side that are happening. I mean, not the least of which is the potential. Now there's talks about going into a recession, so, you know, getting people back to work. So all of this is going to have a push by governments to do fiscal stimulus spending. Your thoughts, Charles?
Yeah, I think you're right that the governments and I think you mentioned the West, but I think we've seen China just issue trillion yen stimulus packages, or, you know, 500 billion yuan stimulus packages, and I think that what we're seeing is the governments realize that if the monetary policy is too extreme, that they will spiral into a recession that could turn into a depression, because there's a lot of systemic fragility in the global economy, right? And just mention in China, like 70, as the number that's tossed around, is 70% of the private household wealth is tied up in real estate. And so, you know, the Chinese state and authorities have a vested interest in making sure that a transition from economy that's overly dependent on real estate development, they want to transition away, but they don't want that to be a transition via collapse, right? and nobody wants that, right? So everybody's trying to kind of shift the priorities and reduce the fragility of their system. And so fiscal tools are part of allowing that transition to work without creating dislocations or a deep recession that turns into a depression. So here in the U.S. and I think in many countries, reshoring is part of national security, right? Like we many nations realized that they were overly dependent on either imports or export markets, and so reshoring is expensive because you're going to be relocating production, and you're in the West, your wages are going to be a lot higher. And so I also want to mention wages, because here in the U.S., I often refer to this RAND study. You know, RAND Corporation issued a study a couple of years ago, which I found quite profound, looking at wages and labor share of the national income and so on. And their conclusion was that capital had siphoned off $50 trillion from the late 70s to the present era from various policies and less than just happenstance, right? And so I think that the demand of labor for a living wage is the result of 45 years of suppressed wages and reductions in the purchasing power of wages. And so now we see this in unionization efforts at Amazon and Starbucks, for example, and higher wages are required to lure people back to the into the workforce. And so that is going to be seen as inflationary, and because it raises the cost of doing business. But on the other hand, if you can't pay people a living wage, your economy is a complete and utter failure. So it's a transition that I think will take a while, but it's a necessary transition. People have to earn enough to have a living wage. And this is now becoming a big issue in Europe, because people are foreseeing tremendous increases in utility bills this coming winter for heating and transport. And so there's already calls for government subsidies in like tremendous scale, right? In the billions of euros or pounds. And this will probably be necessary. And this will be a form of fiscal stimulus, right? To help people be able to afford their utility bills. And I think that it's a positive move. I mean, we talk about free markets, but if we look at shortages and scarcities, like right now in the Western US, water is scarce. And so some of the water, utilities in California are putting limits on how much water you can use at the lowest rate. And then we find the super wealthy are totally abusing their wealth by using like 10, 20, 30, 50 times more water than they're supposed to. And so this is an issue for me, because I see this as the wealthy, and I would say that's the top 5%, people making $250,000, $500,000 up, they can afford to pay higher prices for essentials, where the bottom 95 cannot. And so it's not really a market economy if the wealthy get to use 50 times more of something than the rest of us. And so I think that whether you call it subsidies or whether you call it rationing, in my view, what I see happening is poor people who can't pay their water bill will be cut off. And I think it's the other way around is the correct policy, which is to cut off the rich people who are using too much, squandering, just because they have the wealth to do so. Their water should be cut off, and they should be fined, like, say, $250,000, something meaningful, depending on how much they've wasted. And so this is, in other words, there's also a political element. There's a geopolitical element, but there's also a political element where the wealth inequality that started, that's piled up to extremes in the last 20 years, will have an extremely negative effect as scarcities and people can't pay their utility bills and this kind of thing. We're going to get civil disorder, because the wealthy will have so much wealth they can continue to squander scarce resources. And this is going to create civil disorder and possible political disorder of a great magnitude, an unpredictable magnitude. That's my theory.
Yeah, I see you mentioned at the last second to last paragraph in your blog posting, and I quote, "If markets controlled by the rich are allowed to distribute essentials, the result will be civil disorder and the overthrow of regimes, governments, if you will, by those left bereft, while the wealthy squander resources because they have the financial means and the political power to do so."
Right. Yeah, thank you.
And yeah, a great point. And it's actually even worse than, or could be worse than that, because if you think about, like, it's a bit, hypocritical for the wealthy to be, especially through like the World Economic Forum organization, a lot of our members in that forum organization, and they're pushing all these environmental policies, trying to help the environment, reducing carbon emissions. But there's also the potential setup of these carbon credits that are being talked about. And it is now some of the credit card companies are looking to implement credit cards that have not only a credit limit, like a money limit, a monetary limit, but also carbon credit limit. So, I don't know if you've seen some restaurants, I've seen menus like in Ireland where they list not only the price, but also the carbon emissions associated with that meal. So if you have, some meal like maybe a burger made of real meat versus some other meal of vegetarian, there might be a big difference in the carbon emissions. But, maybe your credit card is not able to it doesn't have the carbon emissions credit enough to purchase that burger. I think we're going to see a lot of this happening, where there's limits on what people really want to do versus what they can do, even if they have the money. And then there's the idea of selling carbon credits, which is a market already existing, but you might have a situation where the poor and the middle class are forced to sell their carbon credits to the wealthy. And then the wealthy, are basically exhibiting the behavior that you've just talked about. So, it could get even more extreme than currently we have. So it's just it's crazy. The actual condition for people to be desperate to be selling their carbon credits, and why we could have a depression is also being created by the central banks now in raising the interest rates, because in raising the interest rates, as all these articles are pointing out, I mean, you will very likely cause the stock markets to go down, housing prices to go down, right? Because housing based more on mortgage rates, interest rate tied. So if you have a situation where stock prices are plummeting and house prices are plummeting, this is really bad news for especially the middle class, which has a lot of their, savings in those forms, right? Stock, investments, house value. So that this would really create an increasing divide between the poor middle class versus the wealthy, even increasing further. So you've got that effect, you've got the carbon credits, and you've got all these other factors that you mentioned. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a great point about carbon credits. Richard, I'm glad you brought that up, because I've often published my opinion that carbon credits, in effect, scrape away the virtue signaling. They're basically an arbitrage tool for the wealthy. And your example is exactly how that works. The poor and the middle class have very little opportunity to arbitrage credit carbon credits to their own profit, where the super wealthy have multiple opportunities to arbitrage carbon credits. And I want to mention that I think one of the big issues here that I want to mention is, I think we're seeing systemic fragility globally, and it's the result of hyper globalization and hyper financialization. In other words, why are we now in a position where supply chains breaking down are crippling, economies, even without the war sanctions and everything, right? And how is it that we've now become so dependent on these really rather modest adjustments in the balance sheets of the Federal Reserve and interest rates? How come we've become so hypersensitive to these that we're fearful of a collapse into depression? And it's because we've allowed our systems to become hyper-financialized and hyper-globalized. And so this a transition to a healthier, less fragile global system means de-financializing, becoming less dependent on asset bubbles and arbitrage and this kind of thing. And it means de-globalizing, which is like relocalizing, reshoring the economies of the world, not just the US, but everybody would benefit from reshoring their own economy and being less dependent on exports and imports, which are, inherently fragile. Once that chain breaks or there's a geopolitical upset, then you get conditions like Sri Lanka, where the entire economy unravels. And so I don't think that serves anybody's interests. So I want to make one last point too, which is, there's been a lot of analysts over the years, Louise Yamada, who I think was Smith Barney back in the good old days of the 80s, as one analyst among many who look at really long cycles. Peter Turchin is another. And so I think there's a case to be made that the 40-year cycle of declining interest rates and declining yields has ended, and we're in an uptrend of a very long cycle of higher inflation and higher costs of money. And, I think a point that is rarely made strongly enough, in my view, is you know, money and risk are connected. The cost of money is, and so that's yields and interest rates and all that. It's related to risk, of course. And so as global risk rises, you know, just as a secular trend, then money's going to cost more and capital is going to demand more of a yield because there's much more risk present than there was, say, 5 or 10 years ago. So I think those are reasons why we're going to see a secular increase in inflation, regardless of monetary policy alone. And so I think we've overemphasized central bank policies and we're giving them far too much credit for what little power they have over supply side inflation and wage inflation and the deglobalization, you know, and as a general trend that is inflationary.
Yeah, totally agree, Charles. The economy has almost become driven by the financial sector, which it should be the other way around, as the financial sector supporting the economy is the way it should be. I think there's been some estimates as much as 50% of the revenues from the S&P 500 companies is somehow related to financial related revenue. So it's gone crazy. So that's a trend that I think will change now, you know, more towards a regular economy. And also I think some of the solutions that you've written about in your books that you also mentioned here, right? A movement to a decentralized economy, more local solutions. These are also tenets of what we've talked in the past called market environmentalism, as opposed to agenda-based environmentalism like the World Economic Forum Great Reset. So market environmentalism is certainly the way to go for helping the environment. And also, I think an emphasis on the structural solutions to address the inflation challenges. So by that, I mean things like greater emphasis on education, on engineering to make existing or diminishing resources go farther, right? That's what engineering is all about. So emphasis on, you know, globally competitive industries, businesses, and more of technology solutions instead of authoritarian government instituted processes, right? So, you know, it's better to go with a technology solutions while maintaining, you know, freedom and liberties and, you know, more of democratic institutions versus going to authoritarianism. Your thoughts, Charles?
Yeah, absolutely, Richard. And I think we've often used the term, like many people do, appropriate technologies. You know, there's a lot of technologies that are already fully developed, and it's just that we need to invest in them. Like, for instance, insulating buildings. You know, I mean, if you want to reduce your dependence on natural gas and coal, well, super insulate your buildings is a good start, and incentivize people to stop wasting resources, right? And we have to kind of rejigger our incentive structure, which is now kind of to what I call the landfill economy. Like, you know, we allow companies to use planned obsolescence to force consumers to buy new products every couple of years, which is terribly wasteful. And so we need to create incentives that encourage, you know, repairability of products and durability of products, and limiting waste. I mean, like, I mean, the number that comes to that I've seen several places that's astonishing but believable is that, like, the U.S. wastes 40% of the food it grows and packages, and that's believable because you just see dumpsters full of perfectly good food that restaurants and other facilities dump because they don't have any means to deliver it to people who might be hungry. So there's so much appropriate technology that's not super expensive, and so we just need incentives And that I think is another, it's a classic public and private sector combination. You need both to cooperate and share the same value system. So I'm hopeful for that, because I honestly think we could cut 25 to 30% of energy, food, and fresh water, all the things that are now in scarcity. We could reduce it without reducing our lifestyle at all, simply by using, like I said, appropriate technologies and creating another set of incentives for wise use and conservation, as opposed to, you know, waste and planned obsolescence.
Absolutely. Great points, Charles. And many of those come from the themes and the points that you make in your writings on the blog and also in your books. Very applicable to this challenge of inflation that we're having now. You know, so applying those solutions is the way to go, not just increasing interest rates and doing quantitative tightening, right? The financial shenanigans and manipulations are not going to work here, because
well said. Financial shenanigans, exactly.
How can our listeners learn more about your work, Charles?
Yeah, please visit me at oftwominds.com. You can read free samples of my books, and all my archives are free.
Great. Thank you so much, Charles. We'll do it.
Thank you, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.